Today, Sunday morning, October 20th, former General Prabowo Subianto is being sworn in as Indonesia's new president. We released a conversation we had earlier this month with Intan Paramadita and Michael Vann about the road leading up to this inauguration, beginning in the 1960s with the Suharto regime. Prabowo is a strong-arm authoritarian figure with a bloody record of human rights violations, yet he's remade his image as that of a cuddly, elder, populist figure. We spend some time talking about how his regime is likely to continue, if not to accelerate, aggressive and brutal economic development policies that have wrecked the environment and displaced indigenous peoples. We talk a lot about how both the Indonesian media and some of its art world have been enlisted to promote this regime, and how decolonial feminists and others have taken on the task to both resist and present and embody other ways of being through listening to and engaging with voices from outside Jakarta and the liberal elites. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. It's often said that Indonesia was the first country to decolonize. Just 2 days after the surrender of its Japanese occupiers to the Allied forces in August 1945. And in 1949, its colonizers before the Japanese, the Dutch, recognized Indonesian independence. It's also been said that Indonesia had one of the first women's congresses in the late 1920s. So we're so glad to have you both here today to tell us how recent developments in Indonesian politics give us a rather grim picture of democracy, and how Indonesian feminism has yet to be decolonized. Perhaps we could start with the recent elections and protest over changes in the election law, and then we could move on to address issues of decolonial feminism. So invite you both to comment on what's going on now in the recent elections and these protests over the election laws.
So first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. I am currently in Sydney, Gadigal land, so I would like to pay my respect to elders past and present, and always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Yes, in terms of the people, we had a series of massive rallies in Indonesia, and people took to the streets to protest basically the government trying to meddle with the election law in order to allow the president's son to be elected as a provincial governor. But I think it wasn't just about the law, that particular election law. People were very upset. People were very depressed of the family politics, family dynasty, oligarchy. There were huge discrepancies between the wealthy oligarchs and the reality of poor people who have to experience land theft, people who are fighting against mining corporations and basically just extractive colonial practice of the Jokowi regime. So I think a lot of people used that momentum to voice their anger, to voice their dissatisfaction towards the Jokowi Dodo's government in the past almost a decade, right? He was there for two terms.
What was so stunning for me as an Indonesia watcher was the presidential election, which culminated on the February 14th vote. If you told me a year and a half ago Prabowo was going to win, I'd say no way. The major polls had him a distant third. And Prabowo, who has this really horrifying career in the Indonesian military, from operations in East Timor, where he's directly implicated in some of the worst abuses of like black pajamas, like commando squads. I think they're called the ninjas or something, at night committing human rights abuses, implicated in repression in Indonesian occupied Papua, and then eventually kicked out of the army for disappearing democracy activists and students in 1998. And as one ambassador said, his track record was so bad, he got kicked out of the Indonesian Army General Staff, which is, I think the U.S. ambassador said that speaks volumes. that this guy who had run twice before in 2014, where he said in an interview that he was indeed a fascist and then ran with a very Islamist politics agenda in 2019 and unleashed rioting in Jakarta that led to several deaths. It was through these crazy electoral manipulations and also this incredible rebranding of him as not a wannabe fascist leader, but as this cute, cuddly grandpa. I was just looking at the campaign ads that literally have him in like an anime cartoon and his Instagram account with his cats and so forth, just completely rebranding. And from what I can tell, really won a lot of the Indonesian youth vote, which is really depressing in many ways. Folks, younger folks that don't remember the new order.
He's the son-in-law of the previous general, Suharto, which unleashed the regime of terror in Indonesia, which lasted for decades, disappearances, mass tortures. But as you said, that seems to have been erased with the youth now voting for him. In CNN, one analysis likened Prabowo to Donald Trump and the previous president, Widodo, to Barack Obama, which of course obscures the deep continuities between both Prabowo and Widodo, as well as between Obama and Donald Trump in this narrative that represents both as being outliers or invaders or vitiators of this liberal democratic space. And so can you speak a bit more to the continuities between the old regime and the new regime and how this helps us understand structural features that have persisted in Indonesian state formation since the new order?
Yeah, that transition from Jokowi into Prabowo is really interesting. And I was living in Indonesia during Jokowi's rise in 2012, 2013, before he ran for president in 2014. And teaching at UGM in Yogyakarta. And my students were so enthusiastic about this guy. And then when he came from Central Java, he's an everyman. He's wearing this flannel shirt. He had this reputation of not being corruptible. And I really got infected by a lot of their enthusiasm for him in his run for the governor of Jakarta. And then when he ran for president in the first administration. And I'll admit to being pretty naive about him and really hoping for the best. And I think in his second term, so his first term was 2014, 2019, and then 2019, 2024, both times where he had the showdown with Prabowo, really ugly showdowns that the second time led to violence in the streets in Jakarta. After that, in that second administration, he initially, it seemed like he was doing the sort of mafia policy of keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Jokowi began to become more and more focused on centralizing presidential power over the course of those years. And it was perplexing to me that he would put Prabowo in charge of the minister. It was Minister of Defense. And like, why would he do this? We know how bad this guy is. I'm like, okay, maybe he's trying to keep tabs on him. But I guess behind the scenes, they were becoming closer and closer, and especially during the pandemic. And now Jokowi is handing off a presidency with much more centralized power, with laws that show much less tolerance for criticism of the presidency in really draconian ways, going after people on social media and so forth, and really setting up Prabowo to, again, move into a much more authoritarian Indonesian presidency than we had just 4 years ago. And I don't know, maybe Intan, can you speak to, was I being naive? Should I have known the whole time? Because he came in with this reputation, and you compared him to Obama. And I think he's like Obama in many ways, because he was an outsider from the political establishment, not part of the military, breath of fresh air, seemed to represent unrepresented people. But Obama wound up betraying a lot of his progressive supporters at the end of his term.
And leaving a legacy of a highly centralized state with much more executive power, which would then be key to Donald Trump, much as you've said President Widodo has done.
If I could add, I think it's really important about the circulation of images in Indonesia here and how certain images resonate with people. Mike talked about this. It's a constant rebranding of Prabowo from the strongman image of like Donald Trump, make Indonesia great again. And then he transitioned into a more Muslim-friendly figure to appeal to the Islamist. And now it's the cute, cuddly grandpa with a cap. So it's an evolution of Prabowo imagery. And I think Because of the lack of critical thinking, I'll talk about the lack of critical thinking a bit later. People tend to feel that, oh, this is one of us, but certainly not. And I think the first time when people were infatuated with Joko Widodo was also because of the image, because people saw, yes, he was not part of the oligarchy, and he was very humble. And Indonesian people saw that it's about a change. We need a humble leader. But definitely, he's not humble at all, as we can see right now. But I think it's really important to talk about how images are manipulated. And I think we will see the continuity of the manipulation of images, especially because if we look at Prabowo's technique, I think he was really inspired by the Suharto regime. Suharto regime was really good in regulating, limiting, but also manipulating images and narratives with films, with museums and textbooks taught in schools. I think he is very much inspired by that. If I could add a little bit on the lack of critical thinking, this, I think, needs to be traced back to 1965. Where we had a communist purge, millions of people accused as being communists. They were murdered or tortured or sent to prison without trials. But for me, it wasn't just about genocide. It was also a form of scholasticide, because 1965-66, we lost a tradition of leftist thinking. We lost the biggest Indonesian feminist movement, the Gerwani Indonesian Women's Movement, and we couldn't access their writing, their socialist feminist writing and thinking tradition. So I think it's really concerning. It's 32 years of the absence of the lack of intellectual tradition or leftist intellectual tradition. The only allowed during the Suharto era was the one that aligned with the pro-military developmental regime or pro-US, pro-capitalist regime. So it's really concerning. We, the older generation, we tend to blame Gen Z. You voted for Prabowo, but there's this huge absence in terms of the critical thinking tradition, and we are still grappling with how to deal with that.
There's a lack of critical thinking, sure, but there's also just a lack of solid information. And yeah, the Suharto dictatorship's in there for 32 years, overthrown the People Power Movement in 98, but there wasn't much of a de-Suhartoization, a denuization. Suharto's kicked out, but so many of those around him maintained positions of power in the bureaucracy. I saw this very clearly with the lack of reform in the education system and the lack of basic things like rewriting textbooks, trying to get the New Order lies out of there. Lies which, as Intan mentioned, really vilified the world's largest feminist movement. I think 65 was an assault on a parliamentary communist movement. It was an assault on labor organization. It was an assault on the arts and intellectuals. And it was an assault on feminist organization. And the particular amount of energy that the New Order, the Suharto regime, put into using misogyny as this foundational myth, these lies about the Gerwani being these sex-crazed witches that sexually mutilated these good generals, that became the story that many Indonesians believed for many years after decades of this propaganda. When I was teaching Indonesia, I was really stunned that some of my really brilliant graduate students who were very well informed on European history or on aspects of pre-modern Indonesian history had this incredible void in their minds when it came to anything after 57, really. And the need for reform for the textbooks and just providing some basic information is just so, so central and so lacking.
We've been talking about change and continuity. One thing that strikes me is the continuity of the developmental or economic mandate, right? That this is part and parcel of the deadening of critical thinking, because what you have is the foregrounding of this imperative to continue to grow and to develop the economy. Of course, we see the same thing here with Donald Trump. Of course, what he means by the economy and what the people listening to him think of as the economy, totally different. Could you both talk a little bit about how the economic mandate and development mandate is built on the back of all sorts of colonial projects and also environmental devastation. What kinds of people are being displaced? What resources are being tapped out that become, again, invisibilized when you think it's for the benefit of everybody, when in actuality it's not?
May I just tack something onto that too, which is also how this environmental ecological devastation and developmentalist imperative is now itself being packaged in a green economy mandate, for example, with the development of nickel resources or the relocation of the capital to form a new green forest capital on the backs of indigenous dispossession.
Maybe we can start with that relocation of the capital city from Jakarta to this place called Nusantara in East Kalimantan, East Borneo. Many environmental activists are really concerned about this because Jakarta is sinking and there is no effort to make the city better. And instead, I think the framework is to just leave this one. This provides no more value, no more economic value for us, and find a new place. So it's a very much capitalist framework. And so this development of the new capital city, it really aligns with Joko Widodo's developmental politics. It really benefits the investors, also the oligarchs as part of the investors. It has displaced a lot of indigenous communities. And even before the relocation, there has been a problem with palm oil, pulpwood industries, resulting in deforestation. Of course, problem with destruction of biodiversity and land theft. So people have been criticizing this, but of course, Joko Widodo doesn't listen to the criticism. And what he did instead was to use the city to perform. Again, this regime is all about performance, to perform a spectacle of multiculturalism. Just the fact that it is in Kalimantan and not Java, it is a claim of this unity in diversity slogan of Indonesia, but in a very colonial capitalist way. So what they did, for instance, during the Independence Day in August, they put on a spectacular performance to celebrate the Independence Day. It was very glamorous. And even the palace is very glamorous and, of course, not environmentally sustainable. But again, if we go back to connecting this to the Suharto regime, was also about a spectacle of multiculturalism, that we are all connected, all ethnic groups, all religion, all the people of the 17,000 different island are unified seamlessly, a sanitized neoliberal version of multiculturalism. So while hiding all those extractive economic activities, they foreground this spect of unity, which is interestingly taking place at the same time as the displacement of indigenous communities. I think, Mike, maybe you want to add more to that?
Yeah, I agree with everything you say. And if anybody goes to Jakarta and they want to see an example of the old new order spectacles of staged multiculturalism, go to Taman Mini Indonesia, the Mini Indonesia Park, which is, what's the Disney?
Disneyland.
What? Yeah, but what's the section of Disneyland? It's a small world. It's like that. It's a small Indonesia. Everything's brought together and it's this sort of forced unity and diversity, but like pretty heavy. And I think Ibu Tien was inspired by Disneyland, is that correct? Yeah. Don's nodding her head. But in terms of developmentalism, Suharto was in power 32 years, and that's an incredibly long time period. And everybody saw that it was a tough, brutal, authoritarian regime. Yet they were able to stay in power until the wheels fell off their economic program with the Asian economic crisis starting in 1997 and then peaking in 1998, where a series of bad loans knocked out the capitalist economies of East and Southeast Asia. It was like the domino theory, but not what the one they were talking about in the Cold War. It was actually the capitalist dominoes knocking each other over. But I think that there's nostalgia in Indonesia for those developmental economic politics. So when I was teaching at UGM, I think I got there at the in the summer of 2012. And around Yogyakarta, this big college town in central Java, I started seeing stickers on the back of cars. And they appeared very slowly, and there were pictures of Suharto, older Suharto as a sort of grandpa waving. And it was in Javanese. I had to get my friend to translate it and say things like, "Hey, do you miss me?" Or, "Hey, weren't things better in my time?" Did you ever see those in tongue?
Yes.
Yeah. And they just started appearing. And I was asking some of my friends, who are like, "We don't know where this is coming from." And then a year later, I was seeing them all over the place. And like at tourist kiosks, they'd be selling shirts like that. And this is what, like 15 years after the fall of Suharto. And he's passed away, but it's a callback to New Order politics and New Order politicians. In certain economic sectors and indices have done well under Jokowi. You look at, if you want to look at airports, if you want to look at big infrastructure, things like that is undeniable. Now, how well is that income redistributed? How well do extractive industries serve the population as a whole? There's a much larger debate on the political economy we can get into there. But in terms of the performance of economic success, I think Jokowi's done, you know, pretty good in that performative aspect of developmental politics. And this is such a callback to Suharto era economics. And I think that in some ways, this last election was an election for continuity. And that's surprising because Jokowi and Prabowo were such brutal enemies in two election cycles. And in this election cycle, and Intan alluded to it, Prabowo took on as a running mate Jokowi's oldest son, which actually broke the laws because he was too young to run for executive office. So they took it to the Constitutional Court, and the Constitutional Court said he was mayor of Surakarta, of Solo. So that counts, even though technically he's a couple years too young. We'll give him a pass on that. Then someone says, "Hey, isn't the head of that court Jokowi's brother-in-law? Like, it's the kid's uncle." And with all due respect, his son is like a textbook definition of Nepo baby. And so this dynastic politics of Jokowi throwing his weight behind Prabowo, and I got to say, 58 of the vote in the first round of the election is impressive. And there was a lot of pressure prior to the election. But on election day, I've talked to a number of election observers, and the process was pretty transparent, was pretty free and fair. There were so many election observers there, but there are various pressures that were put on prior to the election. But my point here is that by linking Prabowo's candidacy with Jokowi, and that continuity of performative developmentist politics, I think that's also one of the things that really secured the election for Prabowo. Now, the big question is going to be, is this next administration going to be Prabowo's own administration, or is it part of Jokowi's future dynastic politics? And I think that from just the making popcorn and watching oligarchs fight with each other kind of a situation, this is going to be very interesting. And circling back to the new capital, I wonder how committed Prabowo is to the new capital, because this is really Jokowi's project. I know that he and his family have a lot of investments in building the infrastructure there, but he seems to be committed to promoting his projects like the free school lunches and other sort of populist politics. So anyway, it was a roundabout answer to that question, but all these things again come together. And I think Intan's exactly right in the performative nature of these economics.
Intan, did you want to say anything else or in response to what?
Yes, if I could add on the creative dimension of the performative developmentalism or the whole performance of the politics here. So if you remember, Mike, when people showed their support for Jokowi in 2014, the first presidential election for him, it was very performative for the young people who are hip, people who are urban, because he aligned himself with heavy metal songs, and even in the biggest Indonesian rock band supported him while he showed himself as being humble. Okay, so we have this leader, and he loves popular culture, rock songs like we do. And Jokowi was very much supported by people from the creative sector, filmmakers. And interestingly, I did a research of these filmmakers sometime between 2007, 2010. They were involved in activism. They tried to change the film law produced by the Suharto regime. So even the filmmakers were mobilizing. People were very much inspired by being a good citizen, meaning you are politically engaged, you protest the law, you protest what's not good. They supported for Jokowi, I think for a reason that this is going to be a change. And then when Jokowi became president, he actually co-opted the arts sector. So there's more investment in arts, creativity. You know, people, if their films are shown somewhere in film festivals abroad, they can easily apply funding for it. They can apply funding for arts or film or creative development. What I'm also worried about as someone who comes from the arts and culture field is that we have been co-opted and there will be more co-optation. All those spectacular performances, the glamorous performances that are obscene, that are very expensive, they actually involve a lot of our friends, a lot of artists and the people in the creative industry. So I'm quite worried in that direction.
Could I ask you, Intan, about the arts in oppositional politics? We were actually both just in Yogyakarta for a big conference, and Jogja is famous as this big university town, a big art center with an incredibly vibrant street art scene. The street art and graffiti is just, it's world-class in that regard and very critical, very open in the politics. And Jogja, some time ago, I don't know now, had a pretty good hip-hop scene that was, again, very critical, and the Indonesian punk movement. And I think the metal movement kind of shades into some right-wing politics, as metal does. But the hip-hop world and the punk world, very critical. Even I think of like the Green Day of Indonesia would be like Superman is Dead, this Balinese punk rock band. But they had imagery critiquing the New Order in one of their big videos. Could you say something about the arts and oppositional politics and especially the punk hip-hop ethos?
And you'll have to give us an Indonesian playlist for us to accompany this episode with.
Okay. I think Mike is better in that area. Yeah. I think the 1998 student movement narrative was very influential in shaping resistance in the art. So it becomes as a ways of being that we have to be critical for people in the arts. We have to be critical. We have to resist oppression. We have to fight against the government. And often they express it in ways that the student movement performed political engagement, in a sense that, oh, we fight against the system. So it becomes a scenario of citizenship. And that's what happened to the people in the film scene when they resisted the legacy of the New Order regime. The film activism took place. It was a 3-year movement, and they took to the streets. They returned their awards to the government. They did all those performances of resistance. But I think we also need to be critical of the civil society movement. I think civil society activism, including in the arts, it's very dynamic and very potential, but perhaps there's a lack of a structured movement. We really depend on emergency activism. So this is a term that I borrow from an Indonesian professor, Melani Budianta. She uses the term emergency activism to describe the nature of activism in Indonesia, which shows that we are very good in mobilizing ourselves when we are confronted with urgent situations. There's a corruption with the law and let's take to the street. But then after that, it's really difficult to sustain the movement. So Indonesians are really good in engaging with emergency activism, taking to the streets and all that. But it's also very sporadic. It's very difficult to sustain. And I would say that many groups, many communities that are critical are not very intersectional. We just have this problem with pro-Palestine artist groups who had an exhibition to support Palestine. They were mainly male artists. And apparently there was a case of sexual violence that was not addressed. Sometimes you can be very radical, very leftist, but you allow these things to happen. You are sexist as well. Similarly, feminist groups that are very much struggling for equality, they may not care about poor women or indigenous women. So I think intersectionality is an issue in a lot of resistant or critical groups in Indonesia.
And thinking of relationships between struggles, is there a relationship forged between solidarity with Palestine and solidarity regarding the ongoing brutal settler colonization of West Papua? When you read the accounts of what's happening there, checkpoints, use of torture, mass killings, disappearances as modes of intimidation. Recently, a video made it onto The Guardian of an indigenous man being tortured in a barrel filled with bloody water, a knife being run down slowly down his back. And yet, Palestine is so often thought of as a global exception rather than an exemplification of the conditions of coloniality that continue to pervade and structure so many states, including those that go under the banner of quote-unquote post-coloniality or post-colonialism. And so I'm wondering, Indonesia, including in so much academic literature, is represented as a rare example of a successful Muslim pluralistic nation state. But instead, how might we see it as an exemplification of these contradictions and colonialities that continue to pervade the structure of a nation state itself, so that rather than being seen as the solution to colonialism, might we see the nation state form as it's manifest in Indonesia and the situation in West Papua, as well as the ongoing dispossession and displacement of indigenous peoples and other sites throughout Indonesia? Might we see these as a site for thinking about the problems and limitations and paradoxes of the nation state form itself?
Okay, I can answer to that and then Mike can add. Yes. So in terms of the solidarity for Palestine, I think unlike what happens in, let's say, the United States or Australia, Canada, where people can risk their jobs for supporting Palestine, in Indonesia, that is the dominant position. Indonesians have always supported Palestine since the 60s, 70s. Massive demonstrations are part of the everyday lives. But I think it's also part of the imagination of the transnational Ummah. If we look at how people protest, just thinking about the last 1 year, the massive protests were organized by religious groups. Almost 2 million people gathered. But the secular, more leftist groups, if they organize protests, they're pretty small. And usually these secular groups would use words like anti-colonialism, etc., whereas the massive groups tend to use Islamic rhetoric. So it has always been huge in terms of the solidarity for Palestine. But as you mentioned, this is quite contradictory in terms of the support for West Papua. Yes, the critical groups, they are very much supporting the liberation movement in West Papua. I know that a lot of cultural and media initiatives in Indonesia, the good thing about Indonesia right now is that we have a lot of independent media initiatives that amplify marginalized voices and marginalized group struggles across the archipelago. So not only focusing on Java, that's really important. So we have support, but it's still very limited in comparison to the general view of mainstream Indonesians. As I mentioned before, critical thinking is an issue. And not many people actually realized about the history that the sovereignty of West Papua was robbed in 1969 with this act where around 1,000 Papuans were forced to vote to be with Indonesia. But this was a vote under gunpoint, so they had no choice. They had to be with Indonesia. This narrative, however, didn't really travel in the mainstream imagination. Among the mainstream public, we could still hear narratives that highlight on separatism. So whenever I post something about West Papua, for instance, on social media, there will be some trolls, some people stating that, oh, these are separatist groups. And of course, at the same time, there's a military operation with all those horrific techniques of violence, torture, and so on. But also the Indonesian settlers in West Papua, even though they are not part of the military, they're also very racist. So indigenous Papuans face not only military violence, but also systemic racism from the regular Indonesian civilians in Papua. So yes, this is a contradiction that we have to deal with as supporters of Palestine, but also a nation that's colonizing, that's implementing all of these horrific techniques of violence to oppress, you know, the West Papuans.
And mining interests too. The reason I first came to know of West Papua was through activism around transnational mining abuses, and the Grasberg mine is one such instance in West Papua. And so I think counter to these narratives, which deeply Orientalist narratives, which either ignore Indonesia altogether or represent the violence there as a representation or a manifestation of some Indonesian savagery, the natives, quote unquote, run amok, as the massacres of 1965 and 1966 have been represented. Instead of these two poles of Orientalist representation, that these are really, in fact, manifestations of transnational capitalist interests as well.
I agree with everything both of you just said. The mining is so significant and so poorly understood on a global sector. I think the Grasberg mine is still the largest gold mine in the world. And if you've ever seen photos of it, it's difficult to understand the scale of this hole dug into the earth. And I had a student who actually worked there as a translator, and he described like the layers of security. And it's Freeport. It's an American multinational corporation. And you have multiple layers of sort of colonial imperial exploitation of Indonesia exploiting West Papua and working with American capital to end these extractive industries. And one thing that I noticed, and I think this aligns with what Intan was saying about the lack of intersectionality and also at the way in which any statements about the situation in Papua can be triggering for trolls and right-wing bots, is that in conversations I've had, it's been very punctuated. If West Papua comes up, it is with friends who are really activist and really have a strong stance, or it's just glossed over and just politely ignored in a stereotypical Javanese way of just pushing something aside and just not addressed. And the conversation is steered in another direction. And the few times on social media where I've posted things or been involved, like it's pretty amazing how quickly the nationalist trolls get right on you, and seems to be an aspect of social media that's very closely watched by Indonesian intelligence. And then also what Intan said, not just the racism expressed against the people of Papua in their homeland, but you see this with students or with Papuans who are living in Java and elsewhere, and notorious cases of police violence in Jogja and the marginalization of folks from Far Eastern Indonesia, Papua, but also NTT in the capital. So the islands of the Lesser Sundas, which are not ethnically Malay, Greater Malay, and have different religious traditions and different ethnicities that are visibly different than stereotypical Javanese looking, subject to really incredible prejudice. And it's up there with the Sinophobic prejudice that I've seen expressed in Indonesia as well. The comments that people were willing to make in casual conversation, just absolutely appalling. Throwback to Jim Crow style racism in the United States. without a second thought. And oftentimes it's really heartbreaking amongst folks I've known with who are pretty cosmopolitan and pretty well educated and pretty progressive in other eras, but that racism against the east of Indonesia being so strong and so profound.
If I could tie some things together, we talked about performative multiculturalism. I'd like to talk about performative feminism, because you had this great article, which it was so rich and complex, and you talk about the privileging of Java and the suppression of Papua. And you likened it to the case of Dalit feminists in India challenging urban middle-class feminist movements, which I thought was really interesting. And you talk about the School of Women's Thought and this remarkable event that you put together in 2019, where you gathered women activists and artists from over 34 provinces, which is just astounding. And you had them talking with and listening to each other in ways that were very open-ended, not pre-programmed. And I was thinking about Robin Maynard and Leanne Simpson's notion of rehearsals for a living. And so much of what you talk about in terms of listening takes place in these very unstructured, open-ended ways of listening. And one of the activities you talked most about was weaving, which I thought was ingenious. Could you talk more about that event and how it might emblematize some of the aspirations that you have when you talk about decolonial feminism?
Yeah, thank you, David, for the question. Maybe I can start by talking a little bit about the trajectory of feminism in Indonesia. So we are still grappling with that void, the destruction of Gerwani as the largest women's organization in 1955-66 by the New Order regime. So for 32 years, women were discouraged from participating in politics, and even women who were very active, very critical, they were labeled as Gerwani. So Gerwani became a horrific label, even though this was an anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist women's movement. But yeah, that was the result of stigmatization of feminists by the New Order regime. So what happened when we had this political reform in 1998, Suharto stepped down. It was all about democracy, freedom of expression. We were left with that void, and the types of feminism that emerged in public were limited to liberal feminism because it aligned with the idea of democracy, freedom of expression, the autonomy of the body, and so on. There was a function of liberal feminism, but it wasn't enough. And there was also Islamic feminism in some Muslim women's groups. They look up to Nawal el-Sadawi and feminists from the Muslim world. But other than that, we didn't really see a revival of, let's say, socialist feminist thinking. We didn't know that Indonesian women were very active in the 50s, early 60s, attending all these anti-colonial meetings in Europe and in Africa. We didn't know about the history. The history was lost. So the type of feminism was very much dominated by liberal feminism, very urban, very Jakarta-based, and often the language of activists at that time, let's disseminate this message to the rest of Indonesia. I feel like that's very colonial. And then we had to deal with the emerging neoliberal feminism, which was represented by Sri Mulyani, the Minister of Finance, with her neoliberal policies. And she was also this typical figure who break the glass ceiling. So that's the feminist narrative that aligns with Jokowi's neoliberal regime. So I think what is also good in terms of the grassroots movement in the past maybe 5-10 years is that people really try to challenge this sanitized version of multiculturalism. And then they really try to look at feminists, not always feminists, different radical groups, think about the archipelago as a place of tension and difference rather than a nice multicultural package. So they address different, we have more writers from Eastern Indonesia telling their own narratives. We have feminists from Timor, from West Papua as well, confronting Indonesia's colonialism. And that is good. And these are all connected through a network. And the Sekolah Pemikiran Perempuan, or the School of Women's Thought, the collective that I belong to, it's part of this larger network. And what we try to do is to try to amplify the struggles of marginalized groups. And I think we're really inspired by what Chandra Talpada Mohanty calls feminism without border. She said that feminism without border is not borderless feminism, which means that we need to acknowledge borders. We need to acknowledge that women in Java have so much privilege, even though someone like me, I didn't grow up from a wealthy family, but I was very privileged with education in Java, in Jakarta. And that experience is very different from someone in a remote island in Sulawesi. I was in a conversation with a woman writer from Banggai. It's a tiny island in Sulawesi. She said in order to get books from Jakarta, she had to wait for months. So that's the problem of access. And whatever we are trying to do now with the Sekolah Pemikiran Perempuan is to make visible all the tension, all the difference, all the anger, because feminism is not about this sweet, a unified movement. We have to talk about the difference and the disappointment.
But it was really struck me that particular event was so both ambitious but also open-ended, which takes a lot of courage, as you say, to accommodate difference in a meaningful and not pre-programmed way.
Yeah, and what I've learned from the process with this collective is that you really need to decenter your feminism. And this is what Maria Lugones talked about, learning from other resistors. So I've learned so much from Papuan feminists, from feminists in Timor. And I think you need to be humble, because it seems very simple, but I think humility is often something we don't have, especially with a lot of NGO feminists in Jakarta, because they've had so much experience. Also, they worked with the government, and then they would say, oh, this is the best way. But that's very colonial. And I don't think a lot of feminists have started decolonizing their feminism in Indonesia.
One thing that struck me, about other things, is earlier we were talking about the lack of critical thinking. And you point out in your article, what if all the critical thinking comes out of the West or the North, right? That these are the people that we, if we are going to be critical, we adapt to their paradigms, which turns out to be almost self-defeating in some ways.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, sorry.
I was going to just set up for another question. Thinking about the multiple decenterings that would then need to occur for us to shift these colonial geographies of knowledge, which are still so pervasive, including in the way that knowledge about Indonesia and non-knowledge about Indonesia is produced or not produced. It's actually shocking, and it's also shocking how not shocking it is, which speaks to how naturalized this dynamic it is, that in quote-unquote Western media analyses, there is so little regularly about Indonesia, even though it's the fourth largest country in the world. Indonesia has been a crucible for so many of the dynamics that have been central in the forging of colonial modernity, from Hugo Grotius's international legal treatises on the freedom of the sea as part of his work with the Dutch East India Company, which set a legal basis for international, transnational colonialism, to the massacres against the left that we've talked about in 1965 and 1966, the genocide, scholasticide, femicide, which set a template for anti-communist violence throughout the world. But Indonesia has also been a paradigm for resistance to colonial dynamics, the Indonesian independence movement from the Dutch, to the forging of transnational anti-colonial connections across Africa and Asia, which, if they are remembered at all, are just by the byword that's often invoked on the left of Bandung, the Bandung Conference, completely dissociated from the Indonesia within which it was situated. And so I'm wondering if you can both speak to these conditions of knowledge under which knowledge about Indonesia is produced, and what it might look like to understand the world if we treated Indonesia as a center for these contemporary transformations that are occurring in global transnational imperialism, corporate sovereignty, as well as a center for thinking about what it might mean to resist.
Yeah. Well, this is my day job. I teach world history at Sac State, and I teach Southeast Asian history at Sac State. So I'm constantly struggling. I'm constantly working Indonesia into these historical, global historical narratives, and constantly like struggling to get my students to recognize this incredible blank spot in most Westerners, most Northerners, most Americans, most Californians' knowledge of the world. It's this sort of mantra I have to go through. Yeah. Fourth largest country in the world, wider than the continental United States, 17,000 islands, largest Muslim majority country in the world. And I'm trying to do the work there just in terms of getting it on students' radar screen and writing what I can write for more popular venues like Jacobin and so forth, just trying to show the importance of Indonesia, as you pointed out, in so many different aspects of the historical spectrum: emergence of international law, emergence of global capitalism with the spice trade, Bandung and the role of Sukarno. And when I teach late 20th century international politics, I like to center Sukarno and look at this moment where what we now call the global South, what we then called the third world, and it wasn't pejorative, that this was a third worldism as being this moment of pride. And that's such a radical shift in thinking for many of my undergraduates and graduate students. So it's not the historical also-rans, but the other historical narratives that have been just left out. So I don't know what to say, but there, I'm working on it. I'm doing the work. I'm trying.
Intan, I would especially appreciate your reflections on this from your perspective, not only as an academic, but also as a novelist and a fiction writer. Something that's always really stuck with me is Toni Morrison's critique of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which, as she said, naturalized the white gaze within which Black men are invisible as the universal. And so in contesting the epistemological geographies predicated on the marginalization of the majority world, how do you write against that without recentering and catering to that gaze, which has rendered Indonesia marginal in the first place, and then all of the marginalizations within Indonesia that is marginal?
Yeah, thank you for the question. So maybe I can talk a little bit about my work, and then I would like to come back to the history of the Bandung Conference and the imagination of Bandung and Indonesia. Please remind me. Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about global transnational encounters and structures from the perspective of someone from the Global South, especially a woman from the Global South. And that's what I try to do with my novel, The Wandering. It seems to be a fun novel because the structure borrows the choose your own adventure format. You might be familiar with this. It's very fun where you choose your own path. But I also want to show that your choice is not really free, but it's already structured, right? And I use the story where the protagonist travels to different parts of the world and reflect on other kinds of travelers, the migrants, the refugees, as ways of connecting, but from the perspective of a woman from the Global South. And I think it's a way of challenging the Eurocentric or US-centric narrative of travel. I think that's a little thing that I try to do to challenge this whole idea of travel, movement, mobility, because these are all the things that have been dominated by privileged people from the West. And usually when Indonesia appears, it appears as a place visited, like Bali, completely detached from Indonesia. We are the places visited, not people who travel and make meaning of our encounters with other travelers. So that's what I try to do in my novel. And also, I think it's really important to think about history and go in a more critical way. And yes, so when people talk about Bandung, people talk about all these ideas around liberation, but they actually detach Bandung from Indonesia. So maybe one way to be more critical about it and to recenter Indonesia into the conversation is to think about the place. So I was born in Bandung, and it was really strange because in 1955, we had the Asian African Conference. Indonesia was the host. It's an important anti-colonial movement. And then 65, it was a destruction of whatever Bandung talked about. I was born in 1979. That's a really important time, because in 77, 2 years before I was born, going back to history, the New Order regime imposed a law called NKKBKK. It's an acronym, but basically it's the normalization of campus life. And in Bandung was known as a city where students protested. But then the law regulated the practice of education. So students were not allowed to protest. They were expected to study, to be productive within this capitalist regime. They were not supposed to question politics, and those who expressed critical thinking they had to be really cautious because the government agents were everywhere. So this is the city that transformed from a place of resistance to a place of a political citizenship. And we really need to talk about this if we want to bring Indonesia into the picture. Also, we need to be critical of the Bandung Conference itself, because it's very state-led, right? It's very state-led, and therefore the perspective, anti-colonial perspective, is also limited by the state-centric approach. I just read an article by Nahid Samoor about the connection between Palestine and Bandung. It's really interesting to know that the question of Palestine was discussed in Bandung without Palestinians. And I think we really need to be critical, because there's a lot of romanticization about Bandung Conference, right? But yeah, let's start talk about it by bringing back Indonesia as the place, and by being more critical about whose voices were there and whose voices were excluded.
Yeah, that has me thinking that maybe I can, in discussions of TPM, Time, Place, Matter laws in California right now, I can reference some of the New Order legislation.
I also wanted to say, Intan, that I think it's significant that your fiction work is also full of ghosts. Spoke about Bali, tourist destination, which, as we learned from John Russo's Buried Memories, is permeated with mass graves of those who were killed in 65, 66. And so the ghosts, both of liberation as well as extreme repression, are ever present.
And the ghosts of 65, the ghosts that are talked about and the ghosts that are not talked about, the spirits that are talked about are the spirits of the generals and little De Nasution. And there's a Suharto Museum in Jogja that has this depiction of the daughter of General Nasution that was killed in crossfire in the coup, it was an internal army affair where the generals were killed, that was the pretext for mass murder. And in this Suharto Museum, they have her suspended like a floating ghost. You haven't been there, Intan? No, it's on the plot of land that Suharto lived as a child. And that's his family museum. And it's, yeah, anyway, but I think that the ghost metaphor is so important for New Order politics and the legacies of New Order politics, because there's this haunting. And there's a series of pulpy ghost stories that you can find at Gramedia, like the big bookstore. And they have the statue of the murdered generals on the cover as this site of haunting. Anyway, I think that
add a little bit to that. I think this reminds me of how the Suharto regime was really strategic in arts, basically, in visual narrative. We haven't really talked about the iconic film, this the 30th September movement treason, Pengkhianatan G30 PKI, which is a 3-hour film that every school students... Oh, four. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I found a 4.5-hour edit. Torture myself.
You got the director's cut or like that.
Yeah. The director, it's really interesting. So the director was one of the best Indonesian directors, not a popular director, an art house director. So they were really careful in staging the communist meetings, this mysterious and scary, and the Gerwani feminist organization as the whore, basically, and the people who tortured the generals. And so we were implanted with these images. I saw the film every year when I was 7 or 8. It wasn't even appropriate for kids, but that's how we grew up with Suharto orchestrated images. And they always hired the best people in the industry. That was a really good film. It wasn't a popular bad quality film. It was really good.
It won all the awards at the film festival the next year. But I guess when the dictator commissions a film and runs the award ceremony. But the alongside with the state use of horrific images in the propaganda film, and also if you go to the museum dedicated to the murdered generals, you can see the Well of Death, which is it was a well where their bodies were thrown and covered up. It's now reinforced with concrete, painted red, and there's a red light comes up, and there's a sign pointing you to the Well of Death, and it's right next to the Veranda of Torture, where the scenes from the film are recreated with life-size mannequins with Gerwani women allegedly torturing the generals. So that's part of the state project, but at the same time, in terms of creative arts under the new order, there's heavy censorship on politics, heavy censorship on sexuality. But one area where Indonesian artists could be more expressive and creative was in horror films. So late 70s, early 80s, this is golden age of Indonesian horror films. And I read that as a time period where this is one place they could go to really excel in their arts. And that those two combined with the state use of horrific images, the horror being one of the few areas of more free expression, combined with the silent scene of the horror that everyone who was around in 65, 66 lived through, or the horror of things like the Tanjung Priok massacre in the early 70s, or in the early 80s, the Petrus, which was the so-called mysterious killings, where young men who were allegedly criminals would be found strung up and murdered and left in the public. And it got to the point where anybody with tattoos on their arms, any guy with tattoos, was in danger of being killed. And that kind of state terror and horror on display in the streets, starting in Yogyakarta, then also more famously, and that really shapes a culture in ways that I think are really require some deep unpacking for historians, for anthropologists, for psychoanalysis, in addition to art critics and theorists.
I feel like we should have a whole other show on these kinds of things, because as you were speaking, I'm thinking about the Philippines and the impact of the Catholic Church on that and the way that Philippine culture manipulates those images, but just uses them in all sorts of very interesting ways. Yeah.
Yeah. There are some similarities between how visual media were used during the Marcos era and the Suharto era.
And Duterte referenced Petrus in his campaign against what he deemed the criminal drug underworld. But there's a speech where he openly references what Suharto had done. So these things aren't
Indonesia's template.
Yeah, yeah. And South conversations that those of us in the North every now and then catch a little bit of. But yeah, looking at each other.
David, did you have any more questions? Otherwise, I might ask one just to wrap up.
Why don't you do that? But let's keep in the back of our minds, let's all think of who we could get on to talk about the Philippines in conjunction with Intan and Michael. I think that would be fabulous. But why don't you take us out?
Yeah. Your invocation of horror, Mike, reminds me too of the rise of the figure of the zombie in Haiti as a critique of enslavement economies and how horror far from being a fantasy or a fiction, in fact, reflects the horrors that are embedded in our quotidian existence in a colonial capitalist world. Intan, you're The Wandering, which, by the way, I'm obsessed with. It's been my nighttime book companion recently. And it's such a radical, beautiful read. But in it, you hark back to the childhood fiction format of a choose your own adventure story, and so many things that are relegated to literature for children. It in fact expresses possibilities that get lost further on in that which is marketed as being for adults or serious, the possibilities of childhood. As you said, the choose your own adventure format of the book emphasizes the constraints under which choice is made. But it does also speak to a context within which different choices can genuinely lead to different outcomes. And so thinking about Indonesia now, within the framework perhaps of a choose your own adventure story, what are some of the other openings for different futures that we can imagine through and beyond the Prabowo regime?
Okay, wow, that's a difficult question. Maybe the option would be, do you want to hear a horror story, or do you want to hear a more hopeful story? Maybe Mike can share
a story.
Maybe I think we've shared our disappointment and fear of the Prabowo regime. Maybe I'll talk about the hope, a more hopeful path. So I've mentioned how the grassroots movement in Indonesia is growing and it's exciting. So yes, it is quite bleak in terms of the politics, but we have different groups fighting, for instance, and many of them are led by women. For instance, in Java, there's a group of women called Wadon Wadas. Wadas is a place. It is the name of the village. And Wadon means, in Javanese, it means woman. So women from this village, they protect the environment. They struggle against the mining project that has an impact on their daily lives because of the destruction of the environment. And the Katini Kandang, women from the Kandang area, they're still very active as well. Many years ago, they cemented their feet in front of the President Palace to protest the mining industry. Women in Timor, trans women communities trying to provide care for each other amidst the lack of government support. So we have all these movements. They are connected, led by women and queer people. And I find that it's really hopeful. We talk about, Angela Davis talks about interconnectedness of struggles. So we feel that we are part of the same network. Yes, we still have problems with groups that are still, that lack intersectionality. But I think this is the hope of Indonesia. And I think if we keep working together, we're working with younger people, we will be able to create something. Because yes, the younger people were stigmatized for voting for Prabowo. Our members from the School of Women's Thought, they went to Makassar to talk about women thinkers in high school. And then the high school students, when they were asked, who are the women that you admire? Their answers were limited to TikTok influencers. So it's quite sad. But if we keep talking to them, I don't know, I'm a hopeless utopian feminist. I think there's hope in this sort of choose your own adventure path.
I'm a grumpy, cynical professor of history, and I'm not good. My job is not good at predicting the future. It's talking about the past. But I'm so deeply concerned about ecological catastrophe in Indonesia, throughout the country, which is enormous, from the incredible deforestation in Kalimantan and in Borneo. I was recently looking at the deforestation maps over the past 50, 60 years. So in my lifetime, it's just astounding and unbelievable. The impact of extractive industries on fresh water supplies, the diversion of water for the tourist industry in Bali, and just at what point can the tourist island of Bali not take another human being because there's simply no space there. That's my nightmare story. But for optimism, I looked at a group like that I've worked with, Taman Anampulu Lima, Taman 65, who I think in time those folks in Bali that have the memorial to their father, Degung Santikarma's family, absolutely wonderful people, very motivated. They have really the only sustained memorial to the victims of 1965, that they keep going in their family house in protest, and their neighbors right across the gang, right across the alley, were the families of the killers. And they continue to be there for 20, 25 years now, bravely doing this work. And they engage levels of intersectionality that I think Intan's really not just calling for, demanding that we have, with environmental activism and with feminist activism as well. So I'm pretty pessimistic, but I know that there are individuals that give me some hope. I'm just, the numbers are just so terrifying in terms of what extractive industries have done to this absolutely breathtakingly beautiful country.
But that's also a very good impetus for more hope coupled with action. So thank you both so much. This has been such a rich discussion. And as we've said, we know so little about Indonesia, and you've filled in so many gaps from so many different angles. We really appreciate your being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Yeah, thank you.
Please take a moment to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. This will help bring it to other people's attentions. You might also follow me on Twitter at Palumbo Liu, and let us know about any subjects you would like us to cover, or people or groups you'd like us to interview.